Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN humanitarians issued an alert on Tuesday over the deteriorating situation for millions of people in northeast Nigeria who continue to be affected by protracted armed conflict just as the country enters the lean season. Millions of mainly women and children are at risk, and an estimated 600,000 face emergency levels of food insecurity because of violence centered around the Lake Chad region that's now in its 12th year. Here's the UN's top relief official in Nigeria, Matthias Schmel.
We've been asking to support out of the 8.4 million people in need of support, at least 5.5 million. The conflict has left 2.2 million people presently displaced. We've just entered what is called the lean season that normally lasts till September. Last year it lasted till November, so we're also seeing the impact of climate change.
Mr. Schmel noted that although Nigeria is a major oil producer, it lacks refineries, which mean that it has not benefited from the global surge in energy prices linked to war in Ukraine. The UN Health Agency said on Tuesday that it's to hold its first emergency meeting about the ongoing monkeypox outbreak to discuss whether it's a global threat. The meeting this Thursday will take place at the Geneva headquarters of the World Health Organization, WHO. So far this year, monkeypox infections have been reported in 42 countries across the Americas, Africa, Europe, Eastern Mediterranean and Western Pacific. Latest data from the WHO indicates a total of more than 2,100 lab-confirmed cases, including one death. The majority of infections have been in the European region. The outbreak of monkeypox continues to primarily affect men who have sex with men and who have reported having sex recently with new partners, WHO said. Most reported cases in the ongoing outbreak have a history of travel, primarily to countries in Europe, North America, or other countries. The unexpected appearance of monkeypox in several regions of the world, where the virus is not usually found, suggests that there may have been undetected transmission for some time, WHO has said. Fresh UN-led biodiversity talks have begun in the Kenyan capital to push ahead on a deal among nations to halt and reverse damage to plant, sea and animal life. An estimated 1 million species are at risk of extinction today, and action is urgently needed to revive damaged ecosystems, the UN Environment Programme has said. Discussions on a global biodiversity framework will continue in Nairobi until Saturday, the 26th of June. Delegates already agreed on a draft text at talks in Geneva in March, which included targets that will involve taking urgent action on species recovery and conservation and on reducing the level of damage caused by human activity. The overall aim is to halt biodiversity loss by 2030 and achieve recovery by 2050, which will require additional investment of around 1% of global GDP. One of the most important targets yet to be agreed is the requirement that all nations keep one-third of their land and seas free from development. If the Nairobi talks are successful, adoption of the UN Convention on Biological Diversity is scheduled to take place in Canada this December. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
British Home Secretary Priti Patel signs an order to extradite Julian Assange to the US.
The magistrate didn't seem to think that the fact that the country requesting extradition was spying on Julian, spying on his lawyers, and seeking to kidnap and murder him should be a relevant factor in extraditing him to the very people doing that. That will again be tested in the High Court.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
The next broadcast of TUC Radio with Mariah Gilardin will be in the second hour of today's Weather on Wednesday with Radio Free Kansas. I hope you enjoy the show. Coming up now is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. Thank you.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
According to NOAA, the highly dangerous global warming gas methane just hit an all-time high of 1,908 parts per billion in May of 2022. Methane grew faster last year than ever before. Now we get a new report saying, quote, China's new coal mines could raise global methane emissions by 10%. The story comes from research analyst Ryan Driscoll-Tate for the tracking group Global Energy Monitor. Dr. Ryan Driscoll-Tate, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Alex. Great to be here.
For most listeners, there's a lot of shocking new information in your latest report on coal mining in China. For example, the storyline reaching the West was that China was cutting back on coal. They needed to control that deadly smog infesting cities and whole parts of the country. What happened to that?
Well, yeah, so at the end of, kind of in the middle of last year, China underwent a coal shortage, a domestic energy crisis of their own. And so you started seeing, in 17 provinces, so in large parts of the country, but particularly in the Northeast, I mean, they were having blackouts and brownouts, and I mean, you were having traffic lights that weren't working. And so the response to that was to increase their coal production and to increase their supply. And so they did that quite dramatically and quite quickly at the end of last year, where they essentially ramped up production, both increasing production at existing mines, but also accelerating the speed at which they were opening up new mines. And the result of that was just sort of a surge of activity. So last year, China hit their record coal production of about 4 billion tons. And so that's one of the things that I think that was happening domestically that was shifting the situation.
The second shocker is the amount of methane coming from coal mining operations around the world. We expect methane from fracking and leaky natural gas systems, but why is coal mining a significant source of it?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, as far as the mining industry is concerned, you know, there's nothing new about coal mine methane. I mean, they've been dealing with this literally since mining began. And this is the reason you have explosions and underground and that mining itself is sort of considered dangerous work. And a lot, I mean, even if you go back to early industrialization, a lot of the earliest inventions that were made were related to methane. You know, how do you take a flame underground to see it before electricity if you have to worry about an explosive gas? So the mining industry has worried about this a great deal, and they've usually understood it predominantly as a safety issue, which is that it's a hazard to workers and to the workplace. And so the outcome of that is basically what the mining industry has done is use degasification systems and ventilation systems in order to try to basically get the methane out of the mine as quickly as they can. And that basically enables a safer work environment so that mining can happen without having to worry about explosions. The problem, though, is where does the methane go when they get it out of the mine? Well, effectively, it just gets pumped into the atmosphere most often or ventilated out, you know, like a chimney. So that's posed a different issue, which is that methane is also, you know, the second biggest contributor to global warming next to carbon dioxide. And so every time these mining activities are ongoing and also after they're done, if they're not properly sealed after mining is done, they continue to leak methane for decades. And so this is kind of the issue that we're talking about here is that for a long time, we've kind of thought of methane as predominantly an oil and gas industry issue, but it's important to realize that mining is actually also a major contributor. And in some places, you know, mining is actually producing more methane than oil or gas when you look at those two sectors.
I was going to ask you about that. How much methane comes from coal mining? Is it really significant in terms of global warming?
Well, you know, that's the thing is that there's so much variance in people's understanding about what those mine methane assessments are. So, for example, I mean, you know, the U.S. EPA will say the annual methane emissions from coal mining globally is about 34 million tons of CH, you know, of methane. But other academic studies have said it's as high as 86. To put that in comparison, you know, I think that, you know, the oil and gas industry is producing, 30 to 40 million tons each. So, you know, no matter where it lands on that spectrum between 30 and 80, it's producing comparable amounts to the oil and gas industries. So we actually had done a study back in March where we used tracked all the coal mines around the world and estimated what their methane emissions would be based on all kinds of data that we had about those, the rank of the coal that they're mining, how deep the mines are, the amount that those mines produce, you know, what the methane content in those coal seams are likely to be. And we came up with about 52 million tons, which is actually higher than oil and gas, you know, when you take them separately.
This is something I don't understand. Why would a deeper mine produce more methane than a shallower one or even an open pit mine?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. It just has to do with the, you know, the geological formation of the coal seams, and you have higher methane content. Basically, the methane content is greater with greater pressure, you know, and so the deeper the rock and the deeper the strata and the coal, it's part of the process called coalification in geology, and so as a result of that, there's just higher methane content in the lower seams, and so as a result of that, underground mines are particularly gassy in certain places. But it's not to say that, you know, surface mining is necessarily any better. When they mine at the surface and they're closer to the surface, some of those coal mines actually do go very deep, and they do hit some gassy coal pockets. And the other thing is, too, it's just the larger exposed area. So you just have these very, you know, you can have these kind of mile-wide open-pit coal mines in which they're also releasing a lot of methane as well.
New science warns the United Nations and institutions operate on methane figures that are, quote, severely underestimated, end quote. According to Carbon Brief, real methane from fossil fuels could be 20 to 40% higher than we have been told. What have you heard about that, and could your own numbers in the new GEM briefing be underestimates as well?
You know, I think it's really important, yeah, to take this into consideration because, you know, I think our concern has been that, and not just ours, but a lot of academic studies have been pointing this way as well, which is that we, in terms of coal mining, that we have been underestimating methane emissions. We know for a fact that they're underreported, and so when you have all the, you know, various countries report their coal mining methane at, you know, into their national inventories, that those actually don't add up to the amount of emissions that we know are coming from mining based on atmospheric science. So there's a gap here. And so one of the things that we know that it is being underreported, part of the reason is just because it's just not, there's not a lot of transparency in actual regulations requiring any kind of monitoring of methane from mining in many parts of the world. And so what you end up getting is mines that are producing, and we don't really know how much methane they're emitting at all because no one's actually measuring it. And so there's no way of being certain. So, you know, we look at estimates. Others use estimates. There's a recent move towards satellite data, for example, of using satellites to kind of track methane hotspots around the world. And what that satellite information has shown is that there's a lot of, you know, hot spots popping up in places where we wouldn't expect them. So coal mining regions where you'll have this huge kind of cloud of methane and is this release, and it's not clearly understood where that's coming from because, you know, none of the mining companies or mines on the ground seem to have or will claim any responsibility for it. So it becomes very difficult to know precisely how much is coming out. With our study, I would say that, you know, this is actually to get back to an issue around surface mining. One of the things those satellite data has shown is that a lot of times surface mines are actually releasing more methane than what people thought, and these kind of hot spots are popping up around surface mines. And so that is actually really significant because if surface coal mines are releasing more methane than what people have presumed, then pretty much every assessment that's used some kind of estimate of, you know, that surface mines are emitting less than underground mines is going to be lower. So it might throw all the assessments off if that's the case. So I think it just calls for more transparency and reporting on what's actually happening on the ground.
So let's talk for a minute about attempts at solutions. Coal miners, as you point out, know they have to get that methane gas out of there, otherwise it could blow up. So the industry blasts air in and methane-laden air out. That arrives at the surface as a mix called ventilation air methane. Can that methane be captured and at least used as energy and converted into the less powerful warming gas, carbon dioxide?
Yeah, there's a few things they can do. One issue I would point out is that utilization of that methane, so actually using that methane, say at, like at a gas plant or something, is actually fairly rare around the world. So there's, you know, the Global Methane Initiative is a group that actually kind of tracks these kinds of projects. And I think around the world, there's only about 150 or 160 active, you know, mine methane utilization projects. Part of that's just a logistical nightmare, I think, is that as far as the mining industry is concerned, methane is waste, right? They want to get the methane out of the ground as quickly as possible because it interferes with what they really want to do, which is to mine coal. So they don't necessarily view it as sort of a commercial product or a commercial enterprise. And so in order to do that, they have to team up with a gas company effectively, and they have to build the correct infrastructure to make that work. And it can be incredibly tricky to make to do that. And I think it's been one of the reasons why, and expensive, I think it's been one of the reasons why you just haven't seen that be as common. The other things they can do is, yeah, they can flare the methane, which would then convert it into CO2 by burning it. And there's a few other things that they could try, but it's actually none of those things are standard. So most of the time, especially coming from ventilation systems, they call them VAM emissions. Most of the time, that's just being released directly into the atmosphere. There isn't sort of a industry standard of capture and use or flaring.
Well, what we really need is a technology to capture mine methane and store it away harmlessly somewhere for centuries. Have you heard about any research on that?
I'm sure there's research on capture. I don't know. Again, I don't know how well that those projects have actually been implemented. And it's also one of those things as well that it's even when you look at the amount of these projects around the world, it's just not. The industry has to have an incentive, I think, in order to want to do that, either a regulation or some kind of economic incentive. And without those, they literally will view it the same way. They kind of view methane in a similar way in which they view rock and other minerals that they find in the coal. It's a waste product that they want to dispose of quickly.
Well, your new briefing tracks this all very well. In 2015, the government of China announced a policy of decapacity. They signaled a wind down of coal use, including a 3-year cap on coal production, but that changed just a year later. Why did the government bring back more coal?
Yeah, I mean, so the decapacity policy is something they've been working on for, I mean, 5 to 10 years, and effectively China had at one point, in around 2010, they had around, you know, I think over 10,000 coal mines in China. And most of those mines are what they sometimes call village mines, just to mean that they're very small, local coal mines that don't mine very much. And, you know, the government realized that there was a lot of essentially what they would consider waste and inefficiencies in the sector. So what they wanted to do was to close a lot of coal mines, to get rid of a lot of the excess capacity, and then to consolidate operations into some of their larger coal-producing provinces like Inner Mongolia and Shaanxi. And so that's been ongoing for about 10 years. And they've actually made huge progress in doing that. And that's something we actually do talk about in the report, is the way in which they actually have decreased capacity over time. The change, the about-face that we saw is really just a reaction to, I think, two things. One is what happened domestically last year. It was this kind of short-term crunch, and they needed to bring a lot of new mines back into operation as quickly as they can and accelerate production at mine projects that were ongoing. The other thing is that you've had some international incidences happen recently that's actually really encouraged China to basically double down on what they term energy security and sort of self, you know, reliance and energy independence. So, you know, those being, first of all, there was the trade row that they got into with Australia over the origins of COVID. And Australia is actually, you know, the second largest exporter, maybe the largest exporter of coal in the world. The other was Indonesia, which is, again, the other large exporter of coal in the world. They also, Indonesia imposed an export ban temporarily because of their own coal shortages, so they were no longer exporting to China. And then, you know, the major country that was sort of making a play sort of on the China coal market for imports right before the start of this year was Russia. And so after the war in Ukraine began, that too kind of create an incentive, I think, for China to sort of rely on their own domestic resources and to sort of boost their own coal supply at home. So they are doing this actively now this coming year. They have plans to boost capacity about 300 million tons. They have various, they want to build a stockpile of coal, about 600 million tons. And just to put that in perspective, you know, these are not small figures. You know, China produces about 4 billion tons of coal a year. The second largest producer of coal is India, which produces about 700 million. So that's about 5 to 6 times more that China is actually producing every year. And so when China is going to stockpile about 600 million tons and ramp up capacity by 300 million tons, these are actually very large figures in terms of the global industry. So that's been, I think those are the kind of the constellation of reasons for China's recent push.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest research analyst, Dr. Ryan Driscoll-Tate from Global Energy Monitor. We're talking about a wave of methane coming from expanding Chinese coal mining. At climate conferences, as recently as Glasgow, December 2021, China assured the world it would cut back massive emissions from its coal burning and reach its climate goals. But then the country experienced, as you said, an apparent energy crisis. What happened there?
You know, I think that the energy crisis had a lot of different factors going into it. Some of it had to do with weather incidences. Some of it had to do with constraints on some of the companies at certain times, dwindling of stockpiles and things like that. I do think that, you know, it's one of the abilities that China has, which is to effectively, they can respond quite quickly, you know, which is what they were able to do last year. I mean, the amount of new capacity and new production that they were able to bring online effectively within a matter of months, it's sort of, I'm not sure there's any other country that can move in that kind of direction as quickly as what China was able to do. It does create questions about some of the commitments that were made. And I think that what I would point out is a lot of times the commitments are being made around consumption and they're made around effectively coal power. So mining actually is kind of a loophole in all of this. I mean, none of the commitments that they're making are necessarily being broken by mining more coal, because a lot of it's being measured not based on the supply side, but on the demand side. So how much coal they're actually burning, or whether they're investing in coal plants abroad. And so I think that in some ways, boosting coal production in the short term, it has a potential because of the methane emissions, as we talk about, of jeopardizing some of those short-term targets, climate targets. But it's also not really doing anything that's different from what they're saying they're going to do, which is effectively phase down coal consumption after 2025 and into 2030.
And how realistic are these expansion plans? Are some new coal plants already under construction? Where are they? Do you expect this to really happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they will meet the expansion that they've announced. I mean, that China, you know, even before China made the announcement that they were going to be ramping up production this year, or ramping up capacity this year, you know, 300 million tons, we had already tracked that they had about 500 million tons kind of in the system already under works. So, I mean, they only have to really bring on part of that, you know, just over half of that, and they'll be all set. So there's no reason that they wouldn't be able to mine that amount of coal. It's interesting because there are countries where that's not true, where it's, you know, they would like to increase production in certain ways, but they struggle at actually making it come into fruition. China is not one of those countries. They can make it come into fruition, absolutely. And I think it's just because of the consolidation and state-owned, you know, reality of those enterprises that they're able to move quite quickly.
Okay, suppose these new coal operations come online in the next few years. What could that mean for methane going into the atmosphere? Do we know?
Yeah, so this is what one of the issues that we've tried to talk about in this report is just to say, first of all, that mining more coal actually is sort of a climate problem. It's not just about burning of the coal itself, but even before it gets to a power plant, it has released methane into the atmosphere, presuming that there weren't, you know, all kinds of precautions taken beforehand, which we don't always have evidence that there are. So what we pointed out was just at the end of last year alone, when they did that ramp up of production and they hit that new target, just the ramp up, so not the total output, but just the ramp up released an extra, 2.5 million tons of methane. So what that means, that's the same climate impact effectively as, operating about 20 coal-fired power plants year round. And that was just from that few short months of the excess production they were making for the short-term energy crisis. What could happen, though, with the amount of proposals that are underway, and this is the other piece that we talk about, is that if all the countries' proposed mines that they have on the books actually open as planned and they produce what they're intended to produce, that could actually increase global methane emissions by more than 10%. It would be incredibly significant. The only way for that not to happen is either for those projects, those mines not to open, or for them to open with all mitigation measures in place and for post-mining mitigation measures to be put in place. So after the mining's done, they also are taking care of the abandoned coal mine methane emissions. We haven't personally done in-depth research into what China's doing at some of the specific projects, but we do know from earlier studies that have been done that it's not necessarily being managed or mitigated any more than their current operations are. So it does pose some questions about whether we'll see more industry systematic mitigation for this new round of coal mines that they intend to open or not.
And one of the reasons that they also claimed that they would head towards decapacity was just that horrible air pollution that swallowed Beijing and most major Chinese cities in the north, at least. And will this expanded mining capacity have better filters and pollution control to stop that air pollution?
Well, I think the mines, some of the mines are going to be mine mouth generating facilities, so they'll be connected to power plants. Increasingly, the mining itself is actually being done quite remotely in some of the northern provinces in Inner Mongolia. And so they're actually quite, they're mostly being transported by rail into the cities, into power plants where they're being burned, and that's what's causing all the pollution. And so the mining itself, I think, is actually quite remote from where some of the smog and things like that are being. I think that too is another reason why it oftentimes flies under the radar or dodges some scrutiny within some of our discussions around climate priorities.
We hear and see pictures of massive new solar farms installed in China, the largest in the world. New wind energy in China accounts for half the wind power installed globally in the last couple of years. So is there much of a chance that renewables could cancel out the need for coal expansion?
China has made really ambitious commitments to clean electricity, and they have made huge strides there. And I think that that's actually something that, I would never want to underplay actually what China's been able to accomplish in the terms of building out the renewable base and their plans for building out renewables. What China is effectively doing is, what sometimes here in the U.S. people call like an all-the-above energy strategy, which is that they're pursuing renewables and they're actively, ambitiously pursuing various renewable projects. But coal is considered still kind of a mainstay of the energy sector. It's still the predominant source of electricity, overwhelmingly so. And so there's just a long way to go, I think, before China gets to a point where coal becomes unnecessary in their energy system. But it's not to say that they can't get there. They absolutely could. It's just to say that there's still a lot of work to do. And I think that the building of new mines and the ramping up of new capacity just kind of shows that, I think we see this in a lot of countries, that, when you find yourself in a difficult situation, like an energy shortage, I think the natural reaction is to sort of default to what you know. And if what you know is a predominantly coal-based energy sector with expands for expansion, then that's kind of what some countries will do. And so I think that China does have an opportunity, though, to really push into their clean electricity production and the renewable sector at the same time. So we can hope.
We can hope. And just to confuse the coal picture, there is a second category for methane emissions from coal seams that are not mined. And could you tell us about coal bed gas and why that is different from the coal mining gas that you report?
Yeah, coal bed gas is actually not coming from active coal mines. So there's actually will oftentimes not be any mines there at all. That's more of the commercial utilization projects that I was referring to earlier. And so what will happen is, whereas methane from coal mining is kind of this byproduct. It's like you're mining in the coal seam, and the methane's being released just from the cracking of the rocks and opening of the new coal seams and coal faces. Coal bed methane is all about really extracting the gas out of, you know, that rock strata underground without mining it. So it's much more of a commercial enterprise, you know, and for sort of gas utilization.
I wonder, is China going after this coal bed gas as an unconventional fossil fuel the way North Americans are? I mean, I think in the EPA said in 2019, coal bed gas contributed about 5% of all U.S. methane production, all the gas production. That's a huge number.
Right, right. Yeah, no, China has had some coal bed methane projects and things like that. Again, I'm not sure how commercially viable some of those projects are. You just don't see them on the scale that you would imagine if they were incredibly profitable. And so it'll be interesting to see what China does. But they absolutely do have active sort of coal bed methane projects ongoing. But again, I think that in terms of their energy sector, it would be an incredibly small share.
It's so strange to find that coal mining is a little bit like carbon dioxide or radioactivity in its long life after the mines have closed even. And so the emissions continue far longer than the humans who produced the coal or used the energy. Obviously, this warming legacy leaks out of coal mines all over the world, not just in China, with tens or even hundreds of thousands of coal mine pits all around littering the planet. How can future generations hope to control that?
Yeah, that's a huge issue, and I think it's actually an issue that people just aren't fully aware of. I mean, there was a great paper that came out in an academic journal called the Journal of Cleaner Production back in 2020, and it basically showed that after a coal mine is closed, if you don't take the proper precautions to mitigate methane even after closure, and that can be something like, you know, you can seal the mine, you can flood the mine, you can do all kinds of things to basically reduce the methane and leaks coming out of the abandoned coal shafts. But that actually showed that these mines will just continue to, you know, emit and leak methane for up to 100 years, for a century. And it's not an insignificant amount as well. I mean, there's been efforts, for example, by some, I think Colorado is an example, but there's been efforts for gas companies to kind of go into these abandoned mine shafts and to kind of basically tap them as a gas resource. So there's a significant amount of methane in those seams that kind of slowly creeps out. And it can creep out in other ways as well, not even directly out of the vent, but you can abandon a coal mine and then the gas could start getting pushed through the rock strata and wind up, you know, in somebody's basement. Or, you know, it's the way in which it can seep out of those seams. And so there needs to be these kind of measures taken after a mine is closed to also stop the methane. I think that's, to me, that's one of the big issues, is just recognizing that closing coal mines has to be proactive. I think that there's a sense that, you know, if you shut down all the coal plants in the world, the coal mines will just go bankrupt. And then, you know, that's an issue that where coal mining will no longer be this kind of climate concern. But the abandoned coal mines will still leak methane. And so there actually has to be sort of policies put in place or measures taken to ensure that the mines themselves are actually effectively mitigated to make sure that that will not be a future issue.
Well, Ryan, I'm going to ask you for a guesstimate here. Do you think that China's coal industry, from both carbon dioxide and methane, with its plans for expansion, is large enough to guarantee one of the higher scenarios of global warming, like 3 degrees C by 2100?
Oh, you know, I can't put a figure on it like that. I think that because it all depends on what's happening in other parts of the world and with the other kind of climate. You know, what goes into those climate scenarios is actually very complex. So what would be happening elsewhere in sort of both the energy system, but even just in the land use and everything else. So I wouldn't say that China's actions itself kind of push to the top of climate scenarios, but I would say that, you know, it's very clear under sort of the Paris climate agreements and, you know, what needs to happen to reach their 1.5 degree goal. And that is, and this is coming from the United Nations Environmental Program and other groups, there needs to be a phase out of coal production by about 11% a year globally. So we need to be taking, you know, reducing coal production by about 11% every year over the next sort of 10 years. So absent of that, it would be incredibly difficult to reach a 1.5 degree target, if not basically impossible. So even a well below 2 will start to get difficult in with regards to its coal use itself. So coal as part of the bigger picture, I'm not entirely sure, but I do know that thinking of what coal needs to do to stay within the boundaries of climate targets, adding more mines, building new mines, is not the way to get there.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Ryan, what does Global Energy Monitor do, and where can we find a map of the coal mines you're talking about?
Global Energy Monitor is an international NGO, and we're based out of San Francisco, but effectively, we kind of keep a pulse on what various parts of the energy system are doing by actually tracking at the project level. So whether it's coal plants or coal mines or gas pipelines or coal terminals or various fossil infrastructure, we're basically, not just, where these projects are, so where are the coal mines in the world, where are the coal plants, but also, who owns them? How much do they produce? Do they have plans to scale up production and build expansion projects? Are they, for coal mines, like what is their reserve base? What is their extended life of the mine? How many workers work there? We track that kind of data at the local level, and it is all open source for non-commercial use. So if you're an academic or writing peer-reviewed research, or if you're an NGO, or if you're, a government agency, or even, an international energy group, our data is open source. And so it's easily accessible. We update it in bulk twice a year. So we try to keep it as current as we possibly can. And you can just go onto our website, globalenergymonitor.org, and you'll see right there all the projects that we track and that we monitor. We also have renewables projects now, solar and wind, and track those as well. And so you can find all that on there, and we have, that information can often just be direct downloaded after filling out some forms.
I do recommend this site. I went there. I was a little bit worried about so much data, but it's all really easy to get at. I just clicked around on a few maps and kept going, drilling down in detail, and I got what I wanted. So globalenergymonitor.org is very good. Ryan, are you working on a book?
I am working on a book. Before I even started at Global Energy Monitor, I did my PhD and wrote all about mining, in particular in the Powder River Basin in Wyoming and Montana in the U.S. And so I'm actually finishing that up right now, finishing up that book project. So that will hopefully be out maybe 2024, 2023. But it's effectively like a kind of a long history of how that region became coal country. We oftentimes don't realize that even in the United States, that when we say coal country, I think we oftentimes think of Appalachia, but actually by far the largest amount of coal is actually produced in Wyoming and Montana. And kind of I tell the story of how that happened and what that industry and what that for those communities has looked like, whether that's conflicts with indigenous communities and ranchers and everything else. So.
From Global Energy Monitor, we have been speaking with research analyst and China coal specialist Dr. Ryan Driscoll-Tate. He is author of the May 2022 briefing, Why China's Coal Mine Boom Jeopardizes Short-Term Climate Targets. Find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. And, of course, try out the easy data at globalenergymonitor.org. Ryan, thank you for keeping track and keeping our listeners informed.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Going to take the second part of this show to wrap up this season. We won't go over all the warnings and threats again from the great climate scientists and authors we have spoken with. I will be selecting the best of those interviews for our summer replay season. In the time we have left, here is the agenda for this meeting. There is a bit more you should know about the international coal scene before it gets us. 2, it is time to face reality. Despite the trendy news about electric cars and cheap solar power, humanity is heading in the absolute wrong direction to avoid climate disaster. Fossil fuel energy production and emissions are increasing around the world. Everybody is cashing in. The staid U.S. government-funded science agency NOAA says we are, quote, racing at top speed toward global catastrophe. Point three, a few top scientists suggest Earth may not keep getting hotter if and when we ever reach net zero carbon emissions. We are developing that news from Michael Mann and others, including with some new science just out. Point four, are we doomed, really? Discussion, well, we never get around to that. I think we are doomed. I don't see any way out. Perhaps you will. I hope the coming generation will. We can talk about it. Five, is it realistic to expect we will meet again in September? And I'm serious about that. All that in less than half an hour. Go. On June 9, an explosion at Freeport Liquid Natural Gas Export Terminal on Quintana Island in Texas has shut down at least 1 million tons of LNG exports for the next little while. This compressed gas was meant to help the European gas crisis during the Ukraine war and global uncertainty in the energy market. After promises of support from U.S. President Joe Biden, U.S. energy firms are booming with 19 new export deals for liquefied natural gas. American gas exports are up over 20%, and high prices are driving an increase in gas fracking in several states. We have already seen reports finding the cumulative emissions, including methane, from fracked gas through the LNG process and out the door make it as damaging as coal. Even after methane venting by fracking operations and leaking pipelines and storage facilities, American LNG terminals are permitted to emit over 28 million tons of greenhouse gases each per year. Seven new terminals were built in the last 10 years, with more coming. Just coincidentally, I'm sure, on June 7th, Rio Grande Village in Texas set a new record of 117 degrees F or 47.2 C in the middle of June. It's part of a giant heat wave sweeping through the U.S. South and Southwest. The famous Death Valley, California, was expected to top 120 degrees Fahrenheit, about 49 degrees C, in the next couple of days. Other countries are leaping into the energy fray, though. Argentina, like most countries, went into heavy debt during the pandemic and now suffers inflation, of course. Argentina hopes to bail itself out of its financial crisis by pushing hard on fossil fuel productions, particularly their new gas fracking fields in Patagonia. It is the gold rush to hell, my friends. If you subscribe to the New York Times, Manuela Andreoni writes a column on quick and dirty cash. That's on June 7th. Venezuela has suddenly become okay, good buddies, now that any oil other than Russian is good. Brazil and Guyana have new deep water oil and gas projects. Peru is ramping up LNG to Europe and is considering drilling in the Amazon rainforest. And even with all that, the head of the International Energy Agency, Fatih Birol, says Europe could experience an energy shortage next winter, especially if that winter is longer and harsher, which could happen. But Birol told Reuters, quote, if European consumers reduce the temperature in their homes by 2 degrees Celsius, 20 billion cubic meters of natural gas will be saved, equivalent to the volumes coming from Russia to Europe through Nord Stream 1 pipeline. Wait, the Europeans could have avoided all that Russian oil and the huge Nord Stream 1 pipeline by lowering home temperatures just 2 degrees? Time to put on sweaters, people. Just two centuries ago, Europeans lived in homes much colder, along with all the northern latitudes. Sweaters to save the climate. But let's get back to coal. Let me read a little from Ryan Driscoll-Tate's May 22nd briefing titled, Why China's Coal Mine Boom Jeopardizes Short-Term Climate Targets. Quote, what about China's mine optimization plans? The new mining activity raises concerns about China's optimization and reformation plans, a years-long attempt to reduce excess mine capacity at poorly performing operations. China's authority has continued to promote energy self-sufficiency in 2022, owing to emergency supply gap with Russia, an ongoing ban on Australian imports, and Indonesia's self-imposed export limit. He's talking about coal there. President Xi Jinping reiterated in March this year the importance of coal at a National People's Congress delegation, and several delegates called for new policies to shore up profits for coal enterprises. That same month, China's National Development and Reform Commission announced its plans to increase mining capacity by 300 million tons per annum, and already Beijing has approved three separate billion-dollar coal mines. China's rate of mine closure and abandonment, or decapacity, averaged just 3.13% per year in that time, according to our analysis at GEM. Yet China has plans to increase capacity by at least 14% on top of the ramp-up at the end of 2021, and that's not including the projects that are signaled forthcoming in 2022. That was a selection from the briefing, Why China's Coal Mine Boom Jeopardizes Short-Term Climate Targets, available free at globalenergymonitor.org. As we learned from our interview this week, if you leave coal in the ground, it may release some methane, but not a lot if you leave it alone. If you mine it, so much methane comes out, the mine risks a deadly explosion unless the gas is pumped out to the atmosphere. In fact, mining coal emits about half as many greenhouse gases as oil and gas drilling ventures, according to a study by Carbon Brief. Just mining coal is deadly for our climate future, and that is before we burn it. A new paper in the Journal of Cleaner Production finds coal mining may actually produce more greenhouse gases than oil and gas, and even higher emissions from coal mines are expected in coming years. Coal mine methane is not a problem that has been solved or is in decline. The public is totally unaware of this, and coal mine methane is not seriously discussed at climate summits. The study by Nazar Kolada and friends finds global methane emissions from coal mining to continue, growing even with declining coal production. The U.S. Environment Protection Agency says coal continues to emit methane, even as it is stored in piles or transported by trains and ships. About 8% of U.S. methane emissions come from coal mining, and that's saying a lot. After you mine coal, methane continues to seep from closed or abandoned coal mines for more than a century, possibly longer. With tens of thousands of mine pits, seams, and openings littering the planet, it's going to be pretty hard for future generations to control that.
This is EcoShock Radio. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
The demand for so much more from China comes from us around the world. American shoppers at Walmart and Target expect low prices that have long been subsidized not just by cheap labor overseas, but by coal, coal for electricity, coal for heat, coal for industrial plants, from steel to cement and plastics and onward. Scientists agreed decades ago that coal burning has to stop if we want a planet inhabitable by humans and the species we all know. But as you heard from Ryan Driscoll Tate, coal production is increasing. Now that sounds strange when you consider the percentage of coal in the total energy mix appears to have dropped in some countries, like the United States and Germany. Coal used to provide at least half the electricity in America. Now the share of coal is below 36% globally in the total energy mix, they say. But that is just a smaller share of a much bigger, rapidly growing pile of energy demand all over the world. The energy market share can drop even while production actually goes up. Since coal production threatens you, your children, and all our descendants, we should note and know who the top 10 coal producers are in the 2020s, and here they are. Top of the list by far is China, with about 3.7 billion tons of coal produced in 2020. That is five times larger than the next coal producer, India, at 760 million tons. The U.S. is still third with 728 million tons, with dear old Australia coming in as the world's fourth largest coal producer, with 554 million tons a year. Just below Australia is Indonesia, which just temporarily banned coal exports to deal with their own energy crisis. Russia is number six with 432 million tons a year, followed by South Africa, Germany, Poland, and Kazakhstan. Those are the 10 countries who continue to produce the bulk of climate-killing coal for the money. These are the countries who need big political and social change to save the world from their nasty coal habits. These are the top 10 coal drug dealers. Not coincidentally, the three top coal producers, China, India, and the U.S., are also the three biggest producers of greenhouse gas emissions, according to the International Energy Agency.
Breaking news!
Breaking is this tweet from Professor Elliot Jacobson. He even says, breaking news! Annualized methane growth hits a new all-time high at 159.6 parts per billion. Now that's the growth. In other words, more methane was added to the atmosphere in the last 12 months than in any other 12-month period during which such records have been kept, Jacobson writes. The current methane amount is near an all-time high at 1,908 parts per billion. Actually, it's up from that the time of that tweet already. Tweeter Jacobson describes himself as, quote, retired professor of mathematics and computer science, now a full-time husband, volunteer and grandfather, know-it-all doomer and planet walker, born 316 parts per million, end quote. He dates his birth according to carbon dioxide levels for that year, which turns out to be 1958, which is also the year that Charles Keeling began the first systematic measuring of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at Mauna Loa, Hawaii. But remember the message. The super warming gas methane is growing faster than ever in the atmosphere. Most methane producers are not regulated or taxed for those emissions. It is often a byproduct of their famously profitable oil, coal, and gas operations and fossil-powered agriculture. No intergovernmental panel of methane concern will gather this year, or maybe ever. Methane is causing at least 20% of global warming and all the weather extremes associated with that. And that is why Radio EcoShock has covered methane so extensively in the last few months. New science insists, without controlling all greenhouse gases, from methane through nitrous oxide and other exotic super-warming gases, chlorofluorocarbons, for example, global warming can never be contained within limits safe for human life. I'll put a link to that new paper, including the author Ram Ramanathan, in my show blog at ecoshock.org. You get the idea. Keep your eyes on the fossil boom. Know that coal is not over, and don't get fixated on just carbon dioxide. But a few well-respected climate scientists now say there is a glimmer of hope, sort of. One of the proponents is Dr. Michael Mann from Penn State. Back in February, he posted something called The Best Climate Science You've Never Heard Of. Science journalists like Sue Ellen Campbell at Yale Climate Connections and Bob Berwin at Inside Climate News have been following this story. Berwin writes, there is less warming in the pipeline than we thought, said Imperial College climate scientist Yuri Rogel, a lead author of the next major climate assessment from the IPCC. It is our best understanding, said Rogel, if we bring down CO2 to net zero, the warming will level off. The climate will stabilize within a decade or two, he said. There will be very little to no additional warming. Our best estimate is zero. The widespread idea that decades or even centuries of additional warming are already baked into the system, as suggested by previous IPCC reports, were based on an unfortunate misunderstanding of experiments done with climate models that never assumed zero emissions. That was from Bob Berwin. Well, this could be fantastic news, if true. Suppose humans seesaw back and forth on fossil fuels, but after many disasters, finally emerge with a civilization that only emits greenhouse gases equal to the amount that natural systems can digest. According to this new look at science, Earth would not keep on heating more and more. Heat, on land at least, would stabilize at whatever level we reach at that time. So if warming goes to 3 degrees C hotter than pre-industrial times, say by 2060, but we reach net zero emissions by then, well, Earth would likely stay around 3 degrees hotter. We would not keep going to 4 degrees or more, as we thought. they say. We could find a plateau. Frankly, I don't yet believe this is true. So many scientists on this program and throughout decades of publishing explain nature has tipping points that we cross. Once crossed, natural systems may continue to heat the planet for centuries, they say. For example, once great glaciers in Antarctica and Greenland go into long-term meltdown, the change in Earth's reflection from white to dark seas will continue for thousands of years. Another case would be permafrost melt, releasing carbon emissions, possibly much larger than anything humans created. We don't know that yet. Dr. Michael Mann has appeared on Radio EcoShock several times. He's a great communicator. I wrote to Dr. Mann about my doubts. He pointed me to some pretty dense science in some IPCC reports and hoped that that data is right. Michael told me he is working on a book about all this right now. Hopefully we can get the big picture from him next fall. But already, we have a preview of how this logic of the landing point works. It is in a new paper scheduled for publication in July 2022 in the journal Science, but available online now with free access. The title is, The Ocean Response to Climate Change Guides Both Adaptation and Mitigation Efforts. The five authors are luminaries in their fields. They include John Abram, Li-Jing Sheng, Michael Mann, Kevin Tranberth, and Karina von Schuchman. They don't argue that climate change will stop when humans reach net zero emissions, say by 2060. The deeper ocean will continue to warm. Sea levels keep rising for centuries, maybe thousands of years. Further, high-impact, low-probability risks, like an abrupt shutdown of the Atlantic overturning circulation, may still happen. But the key point for human survival could be this. It looks like the vast oceans of Earth might be able to stabilize the temperature on land after humans stop pushing more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Whatever the temperature is at that net zero landing space, may continue to be the case, whether it is 2 degrees or 3 degrees or whatever we make. Citing IPCC reports from 2019 and 2021, these eminent scientists say surface warming may stop when global emissions reach net zero, i.e. carbon neutrality. Any further heat would be absorbed into deeper and deeper levels of the ocean for at least thousands of years. I will put a link to that new paper from John Abram and colleagues in my show blog, along with all the other news that you hear in this update. As I say, that is a glimpse of a possible escape from hell. If humans can move out of the fossil-burning economy, the world may not continue heating us into extinction. That does not promise we will make it. We could still be foolish enough, or so addicted to fossil power, that we blow up the climate. But now there is an added reason to try to save ourselves. We look forward to Michael Mann's book explaining this for the rest of us, and perhaps Dr. Kevin Tranberth can join us again on the show in September for more. But can we count on meeting again in September? Who knows? Recently, we lost one of the most lively forest campaigners on the planet. He passed mysteriously and completely unexpectedly about a month after his serious bout of COVID-19, he was not hospitalized by it. This past week, another dear friend of mine and a neighbor, also in his 60s, died suddenly, again about a month after his coronavirus illness. He was quite sick, but he was at home, not in hospital, long after the authorities and the media declared the pandemic over. Take off your masks, they tell us. People we love are still dying of COVID. Here in British Columbia, a half dozen hospitals have closed suddenly, overnight or for the weekend. They can't find enough staff. We have a neighbor with an arm broken in two places who had to wait 8 days for surgery, headed out for the surgery, had to drive for an hour or so, was partway there, got a phone message saying, oh, it's been canceled. We can't find the staff to keep the hospital open. And this is a major hospital. The ferry system, which connects big coastal communities here in BC, has massive cancellations. flights are canceled at the airport. That is how many people are actually sick in this new wave of COVID mutations. The media doesn't cover it. The government is actively hiding the true number of deaths. We finally found out there were over 900 excess deaths in January alone. The real death rate is at least double what the public health agency is reporting. It is scandalous. My wife and I mask up every time we go indoors anywhere with other people. We don't eat indoors with our masks off. At times, we're the only ones wearing masks. We get occasional glares like we're the bearers of bad news. We are trying to avoid the disease because studies from all over the world, including a new one from Lancet, show that COVID keeps on killing people for months after the disease, even in mild cases, from a wide range of causes. Then there are the disabilities from long COVID. In January 2022, I did a special program, The Ugly Truth About Long COVID. You can watch it on YouTube as well. It still stands. Even very careful people got COVID and now deal with depression, lack of energy, or a shopping list of organ damage, including less ability to think clearly. Maybe Moderna or someone will come up with a lasting vaccine that works. In the meantime, please mask up, N95 or better, and avoid crowds. Losing friends and neighbors is a hard blow. If you lost loved ones, you know that deep hurting. The new variants are so contagious. Whether you get this disease is partly a matter of luck. Maybe it will get you or me before next September. Nothing is certain anymore. So will we meet again? I hope so. I will reassess the direction of Radio EcoShock as I do each summer. I plan to offer you the best replays of our interviews, collected at times in the most urgent matters for our future. I will be watching environment news, of course. We both know there will be plenty of climate-driven wreckage in the next couple of months. I may step in with a new show if I just can't keep quiet. But my plan is to spend more time on the river in a kayak with my friends, more hours with family, more time in the garden helping tasty things grow, because that growth, that nature, that livingness, to be alive, that's what it is about. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. And I want to pass on some of the lyrics from a song released by Pedro Fernandez. It's called Laberinto de Pasión, The Labyrinth of Love. He begins, "Life is always uncertain. It's life, like a game of truths and lies. And how easy it is to get lost with words and promises. In a black whirlwind, our hearts are turned over. Like night without stars, like shadows, we walk around the world without reason, until love one day makes the soul. Our pains are great, labyrinths of passion." But English cannot say it properly. Here is Pedro Fernandez to take us out.
Un camino siempre incierto es la vida. Juego de verdades y de mentiras, y qué fácil es perderse con palabras y promesas. En un negro torbellino se nos vuelca el corazón, como noches sin estrellas, como sol. Nos paseamos por el mundo sin razón, hasta que el amor un día hace que nos hierva el alma. Nuestras penas son caudales, laberintos de pasión. Rescátame de perder la vida sin ti, ayúdame a encontrar la salida y así juntos ir desafiando el destino, descubriendo un sendero hacia el sol para
ciegas yo vivía.
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Afghanistan, officials say at least 1,000 people have died, while some 1,500 have been injured after a powerful earthquake early Wednesday. The epicenter of the quake was about 30 miles from the city of Khalsa near the Pakistan border. Aftershocks were felt as far away as Kabul. Survivors described seeing numerous homes destroyed.
It was about midnight when the quake struck. It destroyed the houses of our neighbors. When we arrived, there were many dead and wounded. They sent us to the hospital. I also saw many dead bodies.
The earthquake comes at a time when Afghanistan is already facing one of the world's worst humanitarian and economic crises. A recent report by the Red Cross found 70% of Afghan households are unable to meet basic food needs, and an estimated 3 million Afghan children are at risk of malnutrition. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection has accused Donald Trump of playing a direct and personal role in pressuring state and local officials to help overturn Joe Biden's 2020 election victory. This is the committee chair, Benny Thompson.
What happened to Mike Pence wasn't an isolated part of Donald Trump's scheme to overturn the election. In fact, pressuring public servants into betraying their oaths was a fundamental part of the playbook.
Part of Trump's plan involves states sending fake slates of electors to be counted on January 6. The committee revealed Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson took part in the plot. On January 6, an aide to Johnson texted an aide to then-Vice President Mike Pence, saying Johnson wanted to hand Pence alternate slates of electors from Wisconsin and Michigan. Pence's aide responded by writing, quote, "Do not give that to him." We'll air highlights from Tuesday's hearing for the rest of the show after headlines. Ukrainian officials say Russian forces have captured several settlements near Lysychansk and Severodonetsk in eastern Ukraine as Russia moves closer to seizing all the Luhansk region. Meanwhile, at least 15 civilians have reportedly died in the Kharkiv region since Tuesday as Russia intensifies its shelling of the area. In other news on the war, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland made an unannounced trip to Ukraine Tuesday. He announced the formation of a war crimes accountability team.
The United States is sending an unmistakable message. There is no place to hide. We and our partners will pursue every avenue available to make sure that those who are responsible for these atrocities are held accountable.
The wife of basketball superstar Brittany Griner says she has, quote, zero trust in the U.S. government. After it botched a plan to have the couple speak on Saturday for the first time since Brittany Griner was detained in Russia 4 months ago. Brittany Griner tried calling 11 times Saturday but couldn't reach her wife on what was their fourth anniversary. The plan was for the call to go through the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, but no one was working on Saturday to connect the call. Brittany's wife, Sherelle Greiner, told the Associated Press, quote, "I find it unacceptable, and I have zero trust in our government right now. If I can't trust you to catch a Saturday call outside business hours, how can I trust you to actually be negotiating on my wife's behalf to come home?" she said. The U.S. Senate has voted 64 to 34 to advance a new bipartisan gun safety bill based on an agreement reached by 10 Democrats and 10 Republicans. The bill includes enhanced background checks for gun buyers under the age of 21, and it closes the so-called boyfriend loophole. The Senate bill, however, does not include a number of gun control initiatives that were included in a recent bill approved by House Democrats, which aimed to ban the sale of large-capacity magazines and raise the minimum age to purchase an assault weapon from 18 to 21. An abject failure. That's how the head of the Texas State Police has described the response of local authorities to last month's mass shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, when an 18-year-old gunman shot dead 19 fourth graders and their two teachers. Colonel Steve McCraw, director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, made the comment Tuesday.
There's compelling evidence that the law enforcement response to the attack at Robb Elementary was an abject failure and antithetical to everything we've learned over the last two decades since the Columbine massacre. 3 minutes after the subject entered the West Building, there was a sufficient number of armed officers wearing body armor to isolate, distract, and neutralize the subject. The only thing stopping a hallway of dedicated officers from entering room 111 and 112 was the on-scene commander, who decided to place the lives of officers before the lives of children.
Police had said they needed time to get a key to open the classroom's locked door. McGraw said the door was not locked and that no officer even checked to see if it was. McGraw also revealed one Uvalde police officer who was inside the school was detained while trying to save his wife, one of the two teachers shot dead. Ruben Ruiz was detained and had his gun taken away after he moved to approach the classroom where his wife was shot inside. She had phoned him. Primaries were held in Alabama, Virginia, Georgia, and Washington, D.C. on Tuesday. In Alabama, Kat Britt defeated Congressmember Mo Brooks in the Republican Senate primary to replace the retiring Senator Richard Shelby. Donald Trump had initially endorsed Brooks, who had helped organize the Stop the Steal rally, where Trump spoke just prior to the January 6th insurrection. But Trump later withdrew his endorsement and backed Britt after Brooks told a crowd to put the 2020 election behind them. In election news from Texas, a recount has confirmed Henry Cuellar, one of the most conservative Democrats in Congress, has defeated progressive challenger Jessica Cisneros in last month's House primary. Cuellar won by just under 300 votes. Cuellar is a corporate-backed, anti-choice, pro-gun Democrat who received backing from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and others in the Democratic establishment. In January, the FBI raided his home as part of a corruption investigation. Cuellar's campaign also got a major boost from AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. The group's super PAC spent over $1.8 million to get Cuellar reelected. The U.S. Supreme Court has issued a significant ruling on the separation of church and state. The court's six conservative justices ruled private religious schools in the state of Maine cannot be excluded from a program where the state pays tuition for some students attending private schools. Justice Sonia Sotomayor disagreed with the ruling, writing, quote, "Today the court leads us to a place where separation of church and state becomes a constitutional violation," she said. The Democratic Republic of Congo is preparing to soon hold 3 days of national mourning for slain independence leader Patrice Lumumba, who was assassinated in 1961. On Monday, Belgium, the former colonial power, handed over a tooth that a Belgian police officer said he took as a trophy after he helped cut up Lumumba's body, then dissolved it in acid. The tooth is believed to be the only remains left of Lumumba, who was killed a year after he became the first elected prime minister of the Congo in 1960. The CIA had ordered his assassination but could not complete the job. Instead, the United States and Belgium covertly funneled cash and aid to rival politicians who seized power and killed Lumumba. A coffin holding Lumumba's tooth is expected to fly from Brussels to Kinshasa today. Lumumba's son, Roland, spoke Tuesday.
In order for a soul to rest in peace, it needs to be buried, even if it's just part of the person's fingernail or hair, so that the mourning can be completed, and this can be done through this restitution.
In Ecuador, thousands of indigenous and social leaders took to the streets of the capital, Quito, and around the country for a ninth straight day on Tuesday, protesting right-wing President Guillermo Lasso's economic policies and rising fuel prices. Reuters reports police fired tear gas and so-called non-lethal projectiles at protesters. At least two people have died, nearly 100 injured, and dozens arrested. President Lasso has extended a state of emergency to at least six Ecuadorian provinces. Meanwhile, indigenous leaders said Tuesday they will not meet with government officials until security forces are withdrawn from certain areas of Quito. Lawmakers in El Salvador have voted to extend a state of emergency for another 30 days. The decree was first imposed in late March in response to rising homicides attributed to gangs. Since then, Salvadoran authorities have arrested more than 40,000 people. According to Amnesty International, at least 40 people have also died in state custody during that time. In Brazil, a third suspect in the murders of British journalist Dom Phillips and indigenous expert Bruno Araujo Pereira was arrested over the weekend. The suspect pointed police to the location of the speedboat in which Phillips and Pereira were traveling before they were murdered in early June. The bodies of the two were found buried last week near the banks of a river in the Javari Valley, a remote area of the Brazilian Amazon where they were shot dead. Meanwhile, Brazil's vice president said Phillips was, quote, collateral damage in an attack targeting Pereira. And a jury in California has found comedian Bill Cosby liable for sexually assaulting a woman at the Playboy Mansion in 1975 when she was just a teenager. The jury ordered Cosby to pay $500,000. The woman, Judy Huff, says the incident occurred when she was just 16 years old. She was represented by the attorney Gloria Allred.
Today, our client, Judy Huff, won real change because she fought Bill Cosby one step at a time for over 7.5 years. And she proved with the jury's verdict that Mr. Cosby did sexually assault her when she was a minor, and that he should be held and was held accountable for what he did to her.
Bill Cosby did not attend the civil trial and denied the charges. 11 months ago, he was released from prison in Pennsylvania after the state's high court threw out a sexual assault conviction in a different case. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. British Home Secretary Priti Patel signs an order to extradite Julian Assange to the U.S. Comments by George Galloway, Ambassador Craig Murray, Glenn Greenwald, and Assange's attorney and wife, Stella Morris. Julian Assange is an Australian editor, publisher, and activist. He co-founded WikiLeaks in 2006. WikiLeaks came to international attention in 2010 when it published material provided by the U.S. Army intelligence analyst, Chelsea Manning. The material included the Baghdad airstrike collateral murder video from April 2010, the Afghanistan and Iraq war logs, and more, all containing evidence of war crimes. Julian Assange is currently held in the high-security Belmarsh prison in the UK, pending extradition to the US. Here's Glenn Greenwald.
Hey everyone, this is Glenn Greenwald. Welcome to a new and special episode of System Update here in our home on Rumble, here in Brazil, where I'm speaking from, the country commemorated National Press Freedom Day. And the way many people focused on the ethos behind this day, namely insisting upon and defending basic press freedoms, was by discussing and focusing on and engaging in activism around what I would argue is the single gravest threat to press freedom in the West, which is the ongoing persecution by the American and British governments of Julian Assange, arguably the greatest and most pioneering and most influential journalist of his generation, who precisely because his journalism has revealed so many incriminating secrets about the U.S. security state and the British military machine, is currently in his fourth year in a high security prison in the UK, on top of the 7 years that he was forced to stay in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he sought asylum from U.S. persecution on the grounds that if he were to be turned over to Sweden, they would then hand him over to the United States to prosecute him for national security crimes, something which got vindicated, a fear that got vindicated when the United States, in fact, unveiled an indictment against Assange under the Espionage Act of 1917, which would really make him the first ever journalist prosecuted under this 100-plus-year-old law that was, under Woodrow Wilson, intended to criminalize dissent of the U.S. participation in World War I. It's an incredibly repressive law. It has very strict liability. It's virtually impossible to win. It doesn't afford a fair trial. And so Assange has understandably been attempting to avoid being extradited to the United States, a country, by the way, of which he is not a citizen, in which he has never lived, where he has barely stepped foot in except for one or two occasions of a couple of days. And the United States apparently believes that it has the right to ship him to the United States and stand trial and face life in prison for the crime of reporting on its secrets after he has already spent essentially, effectively, 10-plus years in prison, 7 years in asylum, and now 3-plus years in a high-security British prison that the BBC in 2004 called the UK's Guantanamo, or the British Guantanamo. So it's an incredibly dire situation for him. The physicians and psychiatrists who have been treating him have warned that he has often been on the verge of severe physical and psychological collapse, that it's unlikely he could even withstand being sent to the United States to be trialed, let alone imprisoned. And yet the British courts, after an initial ruling in his favor, have overturned that and have continuously ruled in favor of the government.
That was Glenn Greenwald on June 11, 2022. Here next is George Galloway with his June 19 conversation with Ambassador Craig Murray. Galloway is a British politician and broadcaster. He was a member of Parliament between 1987 and 2015. And he's host of the Mother of All talk shows. Craig Murray is a Scottish author, human rights campaigner, journalist, and former diplomat. As ambassador to Uzbekistan, he exposed human rights violations by that government and was fired by the British Foreign Office. George Galloway.
The Honourable Craig Murray joins me now on the line on the subject of Julian Assange. Craig, as always, a warm welcome. I suppose it was to be expected that Priti Patel would decide as she did. What happens next?
Yeah, I think it would have been an astonishing shock if Priti Patel had suddenly exhibited any interest in freedom of speech or in any other kind of freedom. What happens next is we now get to appeal to the High Court on all the major issues. What happened previously, of course, was in the magistrate's court, the magistrate ruled against extradition on health grounds and on grounds of the petitions in American prisons. And the High Court heard an appeal by the United States against her ruling, and the High Court ruled in favor of the United States. But that High Court hearing was therefore only on health and prison conditions. Now, what happens is that Julian gets to appeal on all the other issues, which are the major issues. on freedom of speech, on the freedom of journalists to publish, and on the bar on political extradition in the UK-US extradition treaty. So now we get to take all those issues to the High Court.
Turning to the press freedom issue, your friend and mine, Kit Clarenberg, poses the questions very brilliantly today. If Julian Assange has committed a crime worthy of this extradition and the potential 175 years in jail, why not The Guardian and The New York Times and the other major media houses that published the dripping roast of Julian Assange's revelations?
That is exactly right. You know, this is an astonishingly selective prosecution, because many, in fact, all really of the major mainstream media published the revelations by Chelsea Manning for which Julian Assange is being prosecuted. And Julian Assange, of course, wasn't the leaker. He was merely a journalist and publisher. And this is a terrible precedent. Of course, the argument is that this is a terrible precedent and a threat to all journalists, and that we should remember, of course, Julian Assange was nowhere near the United States when he published. And Julian Assange is not an American citizen. You know, this is somebody with no connection to the United States publishing outside of the United States. So if this goes ahead, no journalist anywhere is safe potentially from American prosecution. But the truth of the matter is also, of course, that you know, this is very, very selective prosecution. And this is the United States going after somebody it considers an enemy, whereas it's never, in fact, in current circumstances, going to go after the editor of the New York Times or the Washington Post or outfits which, generally speaking, happily toe the neoliberal line. And, of course, which do so now much more consistently than they perhaps did back at the time when these revelations were published more than 10 years ago.
Well, it's an interesting fact revealed to me, at least, by Kit Clarenberg's piece this morning, that in fact The Guardian published these revelations before Julian Assange and WikiLeaks did, because WikiLeaks, through the night, were busily redacting names of people in the documents so that they would not personally be endangered by the revelations. And so The Guardian actually published this material first. And yet not only are they not facing prosecution, some of the people in The Guardian have done their very best to so destroy Julian Assange and his credibility and standing amongst their readers that they actually played a part in where we are today.
That is undoubtedly true. And it was a big problem for WikiLeaks that when they were trying to go through the vast quantity of material revealed by Chelsea Manning, which required them to have other partners assist them in doing it because just of the sheer amount of vetting that had to be done, The Guardian in particular were relentlessly pushing them not to be so cautious and to get on, because The Guardian wanted the scoop, and The Guardian wanted the scoop in order to make money. I mean, it shouldn't be forgotten, WikiLeaks doesn't make money out of this. The Guardian does. You know, the Guardian was doing it purely with financial motives and seeing this as a great newspaper-selling story. And it was, of course, the release of the unredacted material came when two Guardian journalists, David Lee and Luke Harding, published the password to crack the unredacted material in a book as a joke. As a joke, they made the password to crack the unredacted material the chapter heading of a book. They thought that was jolly amusing in their kind of schoolboy japes manner, and claimed to have been shocked that anybody worked out that that chapter heading was the password. So the Guardian's very culpable in this. The Guardian, of course, nowadays is a very reliable mouthpiece for the security services, as we see again today with the its sister paper, The Observer, printing a quite ludicrous further attack on people who query the official narrative in Syria. And sadly, the sheer amount of hypocrisy surrounding the Assange case is one of the dreadful things about it.
Now, what about the fact that you and me and, much more importantly, Julian's lawyers were being spied upon illegally in the Ecuador embassy, and this has given rise to a criminal case in Madrid, to which you, at least, will be giving evidence. You were unable to do so earlier, but are now free to do so. Tell us what might come out of that, and will that come up in the appeal?
It certainly will come up in the appeal. It was dismissed effectively as irrelevant by the magistrate, who didn't seem to think that the fact that the country requesting extradition was spying on Julian, spying on his lawyers, and seeking to kidnap and murder him should be a relevant factor in extraditing him to the very people doing that. That will again be tested in the High Court. It is astonishing to me, as you quite rightly said, in any other case, if one side of the case is spying on the lawyers and the legal papers of the other side, the case would be chucked out by any judge, pretty well any jurisdiction in the entire world. But that hasn't happened in this case is gobsmacking. It's amazing. And remember, it's not only the case of that spying in the embassy. They also were following the lawyers. They were burgling the lawyers' offices. And on top of which, when Julian was eventually removed from the Ecuadorian embassy, his papers were taken to Quito by the Ecuadorians, so there all his legal papers, all his legal documents, were handed over to the CIA, as was admitted in court in his extradition hearing. So not only did they spy on all his legal conferences, they have all his legal papers. And for one side of a case to have all the legal papers of the other side of the case, it's simply unprecedented. It is just unbelievable that has not stopped the case.
Can we take the last of those, mainly because I was myself involved in it as a member of parliament at the time? I was given an assurance by the then Home Secretary, David Blunkett, that a case like Julian Assange's, which was a mere hypothesis of mine at the time, would not lead to extradition. He said on the face of this bill, on the face of this treaty, it precludes extraditing people for political offences. I must confess, I was so naive, I went away largely satisfied by him. Yet I now discover that the claim is that there is no such disbarment. Enlighten us.
Well, the disbarment definitely exists. I mean, Article 4 of the treaty says very plainly there can be no political extradition. But what the magistrate ruled, and what is very important in other contexts of what is happening here, is that a treaty has no binding force, and that in effect international law does not have any force in the United Kingdom unless it's incorporated into domestic legislation. And as the Extradition Act of 2003 does not include a bar on political extradition, therefore the bar in the treaty itself has no force. Now, this is quite astonishing because the treaty itself is the treaty under the terms of which the extradition is taking place. So to say that the terms of that treaty has no force, of course, makes no sense. But it's a line being taken in general by the UK courts. So far, the High Court's ruling has been that, for example, it doesn't matter what it says in the Refugee Convention, that according to the Refugee Convention, it would be illegal to deport refugees to Rwanda. That is not incorporated in UK law. So no matter what treaty we've signed, the UK is not bound by anything it has signed. This is a very strange argument from a kind of imperialist exceptionalism. And why anybody should trust the UK in any international deal when the courts are ruling that no international deal the UK has signed up to has any effect in UK law is extraordinary to me. But that is the argument.
So, of course, the appeal will grind exceeding slow, but that means that Julian will continue to die a little every day in Belmarsh prison, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we're extremely worried about his health, and you know, there has been a very, very plain deterioration, both physically and mentally. And there comes a point where you worry about whether, on his release, whether that is reversible or not. And you know, keeping him in effectively close to solitary confinement in circumstances in precisely the same regime as the most dangerous convicted terrorists in the country, when he's just a journalist and publisher, is something which, again, is indefensible. You know, there is no need for it whatsoever.
Quite so. And finally, the new Australian government, Craig, have we any reason to be optimistic that they will take a more proactive role?
Well, I mean, they are generally less objectionable than the last Australian government, but they're, at the moment, there's no sign of there being any less a US puppet. But I think the public opinion among the supporters of the new Australian government is quite firmly in favour of Julian. So let's hope we can work something through in that way.
Honourable Craig Murray, thanks as always for joining us on the mother of all talk shows. Craig Murray, former British ambassador to Uzbekistan.
That was talk show host and politician George Galloway thanking Craig Murray, Scottish author, human rights campaigner, and journalist. And now comments by Stella Assange, a.k.a. Stella Morris. As an established lawyer and expert in international law, she had been hired in 2011 as part of Assange's legal team. They began a relationship and have two sons. She kept their father's identity secret for years to protect them. The couple got married in March 2022 at Belmarsh Prison. Glenn Greenwald set up the conversation between Stella Assange and his husband, David Miranda. Miranda is a Brazilian politician and federal congressman, representing the state of Rio de Janeiro since February 2019. Here's Glenn Greenwald.
So, my husband, David Miranda, who is a member of the Brazilian Congress, yesterday, as part of this Brazilian Defense of International Freedom, interviewed the British human rights lawyer and the wife of Julian Assange, Stella Assange. As I said, in Brazil, the Assange case has become extremely prominent with politicians across the political spectrum heralding him as a hero because so many of his revelations taught many countries around the world, including in Latin America, the corrupt acts that their government was doing, that the United States government was doing to them. And so he's widely considered a hero in many places. Western journalists in the U.S. and the U.K. love to declare themselves victims over things like receiving mean tweets or being criticized. This is real persecution. And so I really hope that you will enjoy this interview.
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Stella, for being with us here tonight to talk about like the situation with Assange. It's really frustrating and outrageous what we have seen, what it has been done over the decade, actually, to Assange, especially because he's a journalist who put his life in danger and exposed all the wrongdoing of the U.S. government. So can we start with that? Thank you for being here with us tonight again.
Well, thank you so much for having me. You're right. The Trump administration and the Biden administration have started something that is extremely dangerous to world press freedom through this prosecution. And if you think back to the publications that Julian's being prosecuted over, they're about Iraq and Afghanistan, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, about Guantanamo Bay and the torture that has been occurring there for 20 years. and also the State Department cables, and a video of a war crime, which WikiLeaks dubbed collateral murder. So this is the material that Julian is being imprisoned for currently without conviction. He's awaiting extradition to face trial for the publication of this information, which is of extraordinary importance. When this material was published in 2010 and 2011, the world said, oh no, it's impossible that the US would prosecute Assange over this material. It's too important. Everyone can see that it's in the public interest. It reveals war crimes. It reveals gross human rights abuses, and so on. And what's happened in the past 12 years? Well, we've collectively, the world has gone down an extremely dangerous track. And we're in a much worse position in terms of press freedoms, not just because of what's happened in the interim, but precisely because of this prosecution, which is setting a new precedent. It is setting a new standard by which the United States, which has historically presented itself as the strongest defender of press freedom, and in fact has the gold standard of press freedom protections formally in the world, has now set out to undermine those protections with an outrageous prosecution using a piece of legislation from 1917, which was enacted during the First World War, in order to go after a foreign journalist publishing abroad, publishing about US crimes. And this is such a high profile case that if they can go after Julian, they can go after anyone at all. And the world is watching, in the sense that I'm not just talking about, you know, the public and the outraged observers and journalists who are afraid for their future and liberty. I'm talking about oppressive governments who are taking note and seeing this as, well, licensed to do exactly the same with their dissidents, with their journalists. So it's a race to the bottom now. Well, it's extremely important that there are these vocal shows of support for Julian. And I must say that there's more and more. And it's incredibly important for there to be a growing clamor for his freedom, because the case is political. And the forces that have been able to get the upper hand and bring this outrageous case have to be pushed against in order for Julian to be freed. And there's just no two ways about it. The case is legally outrageous. Mm-hmm. As I said, Julian's an Australian citizen. He's not American. He wasn't in the United States. The only connection he has with the United States is that he was exposing US crimes. So it's incredibly important that politicians around the world are having the bravery to express their outrage at this prosecution, at what the US is advancing, because it's incredibly dangerous. Even in Europe, I must say that the UN has been vocal about this, Special Rapporteur on Torture, the Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, but also the Council of Europe Human Rights Commissioner has written to the Home Secretary of the United Kingdom saying, do not extradite Assange. Mm-hmm. And also the Commissioner for Freedom of Expression of the OSCE. These are, you know, these are very establishment institutions which are totally opposed to this prosecution, this extradition. So the more vocal expression there is, the greater the growing consensus that this is an international outrage. It brings Julian one step closer to freedom.
Thank you for that. Do you see any difference from the Trump administration to the Biden administration right now?
Look, I think in each of the administrations, the prosecution of Julian has been a highly contested internally in the administration issue. So with the Obama administration, we know that they were looking whether they should prosecute him, and they decided not to. And Obama, in fact, commuted Chelsea Manning's sentence. You know, that was a clear political signal. Do not prosecute Assange and commute Chelsea Manning's sentence. So Chelsea Manning was freed at the end of the Obama administration. Then Trump came in with a very antagonistic relationship with the press, and leaks were, you know, constant during the Trump administration. He basically took the Obama war on leaks up a level, and so wanted to set a precedent by going after the press, and he did that through the prosecution of Julian, and that was, you know, especially instigated by the CIA's wrath over a WikiLeaks publication of Vault 7. You know, there's even reports about conversation between the FBI head James Comey and Donald Trump saying, well, we need to prosecute journalists. We need a head on a pike. And Julian is that head on a pike. So with the Biden administration, look, Biden was part of Obama's administration. I know there is a lot of internal disagreement. And that's an opportunity, and that's reason for hope. That's reason to keep repeating the message and being louder and louder and getting more and more allies on side calling for this to end.
That was part of an interview between Stella Assange, a.k.a. Stella Morris, and Brazilian politician David Miranda. Stella Assange is an international lawyer and wife of Julian Assange. They have two children. This interview ran on June 11, 2022 on System Update, a program hosted by journalist, author, and lawyer Glenn Greenwald. You can hear the full episodes on George Galloway's Mother of All Talk Shows, number 161, and the June 11, 2022 segment of System Update on Rumble. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.